everybody is under quarantine.
Hi, and welcome to Jump Scare, the horror podcast that sees it coming. I'm Shanice.
And I'm Will.
And we are finishing up our contagious, infectious, viral diseases arc.
That's right. And we are finishing it today with Pontypool.
Pontypool, which is a Canadian film. So we are drinking a Canadian drink. Bring out your dead, which makes sense. And it's a good old stout for a just really fucking weird movie.
This is a weird movie, yeah. This is not at all what I was expecting when I hit play. I don't know what I was expecting. I'd heard that this was a bit of a left field flick, but this is not at all what I thought a horror movie could be, but I loved it.
It clearly has a lot of fun. And like I said to you before, like, it's the sort of movie where people are like, hey, this is really weird. And you're like, how's it weird? And you're like, I can't explain it. You have to watch it.
Yeah, just have to see it.
So give us some background. What's the year?
This was released in 2009. It was directed by a guy named Bruce McDonald, who apparently had like a fairly lengthy career in independent film. I hadn't heard of any of the other things he'd done, but he's definitely one of these like very active underground film guys up in Canada.
Oh yeah, there's one thing that he's worked on that you may have heard of. He's directed a couple episodes of Degrassi, The Next Generation.
Wow.
Which I feel like is a terrible like stereotype to Canadians of like everyone has had a hand in creating a Degrassi right. show in Canada.
Everyone is connected to Drake somehow.
But yeah, he is like a very well-known indie and like has remained in the indie scene, I think, is the sort of person that like if I went commercial, it wouldn't be punk rock anymore. And did Hardcore Logo, Roadkill. He like once shot one of his films on a Super 8. Like this is like a man that believes in the art form of film and like horror and scaring people.
That's awesome. And this movie was written by a guy named Tony Burgess, who is kind of a well-known novelist and screenwriter. It's based on his own novel called Pontypool Changes Everything, which I guess was one of his more successful works. But to me, seems like someone who's also in the vein we just talked about, someone who has been sort of toiling in the trenches of genre art. Speculative fiction for a long time.
Yeah, and fun fact, Pontypool Changes Everything was supposed to be the name of one of the sequels to Pontypool, which is just like a weird, interesting...
Yeah.
I don't think these movies are ever going to get the sequels that they keep on saying that they will, but one of them was supposed to be called Pontypool Changes Everything. And I think he not only wrote the novel and the screenplay for this, but he also wrote the radio play. So he, like, has told this story in three different ways. So clearly loves it very much.
Yeah. Well, it's a compelling story. I can see why. It's a weird one, you know? It's just, there's a brilliance to it. And so the other creator we should mention here is, if I'm saying this right, Claude Foisy.
That sounds right. That sounds very French.
Yeah, right? he did the score, which, as you know, you've noted in the notes here, Shanice, is definitely a character in this film.
100%. The sound design, the score, just it. I mean, that is the point of this movie. And it's just, it does an amazing job of just, oh God, it's just, it. There's no explaining it. I couldn't find anything else that he had worked on, which is a little weird. Mm-hmm. So he may have just did this and been like, all right, I'm never going to top this shit. But good on you, Claude. You did a great job.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the sound in this film is so good and captures all the little nuances of radio. The way early in the film when the main character is recording his radio show and they keep cutting back and forth between the camera being in the room with the producer and hearing her in a regular way and then cutting into the DJ's sound booth room and just having the voice be a little grainier through the speaker. I don't know. I just found that really effective and the way they just gave you a real sense of place within this confined environment just through these small sound design details. It was some virtuoso directing, I thought.
Yeah. And I mean, it also just like, particularly that scene represents the idea of layers and like reading between the lines so well of like, mm-hmm. he's listening and he's saying this like weird fucked up shit. And she's just like, don't do that. Don't bully her, whatever. And it's the idea that like no one else can hear it, but he can and we can. And yeah. he like chooses to ignore it. It's just like, yeah, you have to choose to ignore stuff, like, which, you know, becomes a bigger deal later in the film. But it's just it like, again, it's perfect that like it comes out as that like canned, grainy, like in his headphones. Oh, it's just it's brilliant.
It's brilliant. Yeah. Honestly, a lot of those scenes, especially early on, weirdly reminded me of Aaron Sorkin. The way, and maybe it's just because they're so reminiscent of Newsroom, and so we actually get very similar scenes. But like that, like you said, that back and forth, the layered conversations, the audience is hearing what he's representing, but also hearing what the DJ has in his ear, and so he's getting like all these character notes between those two, and it's dynamic with the very active camera, and it was so good, and it reminded me of the energy of like a good Sorkin scene.
Yeah, I could see that for sure. So the marketing, I couldn't really find a lot for the marketing of this. Uh-huh. Yeah, there wasn't much, and like it kind of makes sense. I think that looking back at this would be a very difficult film to market. Like I watched a couple of the different trailers, and it's the sort of thing where there. The power of this film and like the way that it makes you feel is this idea that it is so you're confined to the one space. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's really difficult to sort of show audiences in a 2-minute trailer, because it's sort of like when you've got 2 minutes to do that, you're kind of like, this is just the same thing over and over, especially something like a radio station that like isn't very visually, you know, quote unquote, dynamic.
Right.
And it's so much of it is based on the sound. So I feel like they probably had trouble marketing it because it is the sort of thing that you had to, in fact, go and experience.
Yeah.
But they did a good job with their taglines, which were shut up or die, which I love. And then the second one is like my favorite like tagline I've ever read. And it's words lose their meaning when you repeat them. And I love that so much because that is so true. Like, how many times a day do we say that? It's like, oh, I keep on saying this word. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, definitely.
That's like relatable enough to get you to stop and be like, wait, what?
Yeah, definitely. I agree. Definitely some marketing challenges with this film. Yeah, and it's like a conceptual movie in a lot of ways, right? So that's very hard to sell in like a 30-second clip.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I think, and we talk about this all the time, horror movies are, unless they're sort of that action-y sort of feel, it's hard to convey enough information in a commercial or a trailer, which is why I think horror films have definitely sort of, they're winning at the fact that like the internet's a thing now, because now you can have a really intense like, you know, AR game, and like people have to like click around and like find this, and they learn so much about the movie before. But like back in the day, if it was just like, yeah, here's a you know, here's just 2-minute spot on TV, people are like, ugh, I don't want to be scared, like change the channel, it's prime time, we're watching Friends, like turn right. this shit off.
Right, definitely. I also think it's a movie about a workplace, and that can be really compelling on screen, but it's hard to sell it. Like most people wouldn't care about kind of learning about how a radio station works and all the details of what goes into that. It doesn't sound particularly compelling, but it is really compelling on screen as almost a separate piece from the horror aspects of this film. It's just, there's like a lot of pleasure in just watching them put on the radio show, especially the first half of the movie, and seeing how that works. But yeah, again, that's a hard thing to like convince someone of. They kind of have to see it in motion to get it.
And speaking of convincing, they definitely didn't convince enough people.
And they didn't at all.
So how much did it cost? to make this movie?
We don't know. So we found a $1.5 million figure that's on thenumbers.com, which is a site that we look to sometimes that seems to be one of the more complete collections of budget information for movies, but I'm never sure how accurate it is. None of these numbers are really sourced. So I don't know if they really spent $1.5 million on this movie. It doesn't look that way. You and I are both surprised sometimes by how much movies cost compared to how much we think they're going to cost. But if it did cost $1.5 million, then, man, what a financial disaster this film was.
Yeah, how much did it make back?
It made back about $32,000 total.
Which is insane. So, like, I refuse to believe that it cost this much to make this movie. One, because they didn't use... Not that the actors weren't well-known, but there was no one there that, like, demanded an insane amount of money. And two, like, they filmed it in A, a real radio station, and B, in one spot. Like, what?
Yeah.
Where would your $1.5 million, like, dollars have gone? Like, there are effects, sure.
Some.
So the only thing that I could see costing a lot of money is everything that was done in post. So not only, like, the visual effects, but also sound design. Definitely... Mm-hmm. Would cost a lot of money. But God, it just like made no money back. And it was because it was like in three fucking Canadian theaters. And they were like a year later, like, fine, let's put it on DVD and Blu-ray. But like it didn't get a really wide release.
I honestly wonder if it had gotten a wide release, it would have obviously made a more like baseline normal figure of a couple hundred grand. But I can't see this movie really being a big... success. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know. I think it would have been a huge success in the foreign market, like not America, because it at its core sort of mocks the English language, which people love to do. English, you know, is not everyone's favorite language around the world. So I think that it would have done well for that. I think that the French would not have loved it because there's a whole thing about like French Canadians and like actual French and whose accent is correct. But I think had it like gone to Europe, I do think that it would have been a little more successful.
I don't know. To me, it might just be just an intrinsically underground film. Like it just not most people. I shouldn't say most people. A lot of people would have trouble getting through even the opening scene with that like monologue,
which
I loved.
Yeah.
But I guess we'll never know because it never got any sort of release, really. And really just kind of lived on in rentals and Netflix. It was on Netflix for a long time. It was on Shudder for a long time. Like, it's that kind of movie, I think.
Yeah. It's also definitely the kind of thing that, again, like, students talk about and have to watch and learn about. Right. Like, I do think that it had a life after being in theaters. Because I can remember watching this movie at the IFC Theater in New York. So I feel like I was telling you this. I think that it probably made more money after its initial release. Because it does go back to theaters and get played often because it's like a quote-unquote sleeper hit. So who knows?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there... I don't know. It does have a life. You do see it around. It's fairly well-known among... dedicated horror fans. So it's not, I wouldn't call it super underground, but not a financial juggernaut.
Not at all. So this movie clearly is a whole mess of WTF, what the fuck moments.
Yeah.
And we're going to do it justice by picking out, you know, some good ones.
Yeah. So starting with best scare, Shanice, I have one, but why don't you share yours? Because I think you actually are correct here.
So, just so y'all know, we fill these out like right before we record so that we don't convince the other of anything. My what the fuck moment and best scare. So, like, I think it's hard to define best scare in this movie because so much, the entire first half of this film is just a buildup to something. And there's nothing scarier than that. However, there's a scene where we, you know, we've heard the emergency broadcast, you know, don't use terms of endearment, blah, blah, blah. And the guy, one of the guys who works at the radio station, calls in and is like, yeah, shit's being crazy. And he's trying to explain what's happening. And I think like his wife's in the background. She's like, what are you doing? What are we doing? Like, you just hear her very, like, not as strongly in the background. And he's explaining that they ran into a teenager and his legs are pointed up in like weird directions and nothing makes sense. And like, you would think that that's scary. Like, it can't get any worse than that. Then you hear like a child's voice.
Yeah.
Like, just speaking in general. And like, kids are fucking creepy always. There's nothing creepier to me than like adults using baby voices. Like, yeah, do it with your pets, but there's something that like makes it really scary in a horror movie specifically. And then he says this line that scares the hell out of me, and it sounds like there's a child screaming inside his breath. And like the fucking layers of that like this person, yeah, is breathing, they're clearly not making any noise, but there's a child screaming while his mouth is open. And like, what makes that scene so scary is that we've got Grant. That actor's acting is amazing throughout this entire film. So it's like a close-up, yeah, shot of him, and then, you know, these strings key up, and he's trying his hardest to, A, remain calm, because he's live on the air and there are people in the room with him. B, this is someone that he knows, and there's just like a slight flash of panic where he furrows his eyebrow and then stops. And like, that's terrifying to me, because it's the sort of thing where like, you can't acknowledge the fear. Like, you're not allowed to. And he doesn't want to. And of course no one wants to. God, yeah, it's just a really scary scene. It also is a scary scene. So like, if you, this sounds super pretentious, but like, this is a movie that you unfortunately have to really pay attention to everything that's said. And the emergency broadcast starts off with like, don't use terms of endearment. And like, you have to think about children in this way, because kids don't know their parents or their family members by anything but a term of endearment. Like, they call their parents mom and dad, which is technically a term of endearment. So there's like this moment where you think like, fuck, all of these kids were probably the first ones being murdered.
Oh yeah.
Because they don't know any better. Like, there's just so many layers to how fucked up this one scene is. And it scares me, because the idea of not being able to trust your own ears and eyes and like not trust reality is terrifying to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think this is the scariest moment. It also, just the fact that it's not really explained, like by the time you get to the end of the movie and you understand that it's in, the virus is in language and it's trying to spread, none of that explains why the child was inside the person.
Right?
And it's so, it does suggest that there's something, there's way more going on than the movie is telling you. And that, like, there's layers to whatever this is. And it's, like, really weird and really dark. And, yeah, it's more than just like, what's happening? Okay, by the end of the movie, we know what's happening, and this is how you stop it, and that's it.
And it's the core of this movie. It's deeply unsettling, because you want answers, and here we are watching the people who would normally give us the answers. They're the news. They're the ones who would tell us the answers of what the fuck is going on, and they don't even know? Like, that sucks.
Yeah. So the other entry for best scare that I would submit is Laurel Ann's reappearance. So like, she's banging against the glass and then she disappears for a bit, and then she like reappears a little bit later in the movie, and she's all like bleeding, like she's chewed her lip off, and it's really gruesome. And it's just, it's a stark visualization to a film that up until then and after this is pretty bloodless, is pretty conceptual and kind of psychological in how it works its horror. So to see this character that you'd kind of gotten attached to and that you know is like resourceful, and she's like young and attractive and very sympathetic, she's the type of character that you don't expect to go first, you know. Mm-hmm. There's no like tokenism to her character. She's the sort of person that you expect to like save the day at the end. So to see her almost immediately get cut down and then slowly kind of disintegrate physically in front of your eyes, I thought was a pretty effective counterweight to all the psychological stuff that's going on.
Well, yeah, you also get like the feeling that like she's the spirit of the radio station in terms of like being so young and like, you know, there's a point where she gets really jokey when God, it's like early on in the film, she like tells the radio DJ something that she wasn't supposed to until it was verified. Like she's got this cheeky. It's just like sort of fucked up because you're like, oh, like the spirit and the fun isn't even safe in this case.
Yeah. Okay. So what would you say is the most iconic scene in Pontypool?
So I feel like we have to reverse this and you have to go first.
Okay, that's fair. So I would say the opening shot, just the close-up of the sound and the DJ's Grant. Is his name Grant? Grant Mazzy, right? Yeah. Grant Mazzy's monologue, which doesn't really make sense, but it totally sets the tone. And like even having watched the film, it doesn't really make sense. But sets the tone for the film that's going to be a little bit disorienting, a little bit kind of viscerally affecting, going to play with this conceit of like radio and language in a way that is sort of more about building menace than about outright horror for the most part. I just thought it was a really cool way to start a film and set a tone. Reminded me a lot of like a Videodrome or like a David Cronenberg kind of.
Yeah. Moment. No, for sure. I would agree with that. It like would also, the opening scene is so good because it really like sets the standard of visually what kind of movie you're watching. Of like you watch that and you're prepared for a film of tight fucking shots. And yeah. I love when a movie starts off like that because I'm like, oh, you're gonna be consistent. And also they're great tight shots. It's not willy-nilly of like, oh, we're, you know, zoom in because this is an emotional moment. It's just the sort of thing that like it really sets the precedent of like what these characters are saying and how they are speaking is important and not necessarily what they're saying, because you're right, what he says is kind of like, what the fuck are you talking about, man? But it's just this idea of like the importance placed on character speaking. Like it's brilliant. It's so smart. I would, yeah, definitely yeah. Iconic.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the opening, the car scene is when he's driving in the car is great too. Again, like you said, another really tight shot. Well done. It's incredibly nerve-wracking in a way that like very few car scenes are for me. Just being like snowed in like that and having the traffic pass and then the disorienting encounter with the woman who just like disappears back into the snow.
Yeah.
The whole thing is just really well done. Like I said, there's a lot of real virtuoso directing kind of going on here, and it's not like you referenced Christopher Nolan. It's not like the Christopher Nolan incredible visuals and like very flashy, you know, or like Tarantino-esque, like very self-referential and like I am being a director now kind of stuff. It's just very subtle and incredibly competent filmmaking.
Yeah, no, truly. It's I think that goes to show how well Bruce understood the story.
Yeah.
That like is a complicated and very bizarre story. Like it's hard. I've read it and I can't, like if I had not seen this film before I read that, I would have found it really hard to connect the importance of the text, if that makes any sense.
Uh-huh.
And you can tell that like he immediately off the bat like fucking understood what this was supposed to be about.
Yeah, definitely.
So my most iconic, so the real ending, the ending, and right. The after credit scene, which initially in the initial cut of this film was the end scene, period. And then people watched it and were like, what? This makes no sense. And actually, a lot of people miss this scene because you don't really get after credit scenes in horror movies. So, like, usually, like, you hit the credits and you're like, I need to get the fuck out of this dark theater. Like, I'm done. No, thank you. So there's an after credit scene. And it's in black and white. And it's a weird fucking scene.
Yes, it is.
And I think it's iconic because, one, for the people who do watch it, or, you know, you do go back and watch it, it does what art is supposed to do, and it opens up a discussion of what the fuck was that? And, like, I love nothing more than being left with questions after watching something. And I think, you know, the actual end of the film does that. But this leads to new questions of, have they truly lost their minds? What is the nature of their reality at this point? What was the nature of their reality at the beginning of the film? Like, it right. makes you question, at what point did they truly lose it? Because the whole idea is, you beat this by, you know, or, like, not making sense. Like, I don't know. It's just, like, it's iconic because it truly does something interesting in that it makes you question the last hour and a half that you just watched, because you're like, was any of that legitimate?
right, totally, it does. Yeah, it's just absolutely, I don't know, out of place. Visually very different.
Yeah
visually reminds me of Guy Madden a little bit, and I don't know if it's just because it's Canadian, but I'm wondering if this is a bit of a Guy Madden shout out, with the sort of old-timey black and white.
Yeah, I always interpreted it as sort of like a callback to, I don't know, like, what sparked this entire film is War of the Worlds. And yeah. This idea of, like, old, you know, pop culture and Hollywood. I don't know. It's up for fucking debate and discussion, and I love right. that.
Totally. All right. So we like to go through the body count in these films, and this was a movie without much of a body count at all.
I warned you. I warned you that this would be another movie where we would be like, oh.
Yeah. So I have two. I think we actually see two people die.
Yeah. I think, yeah, we only technically, yeah.
Right. Laura Ann and that one zombie girl mm-hmm. that Grant kills. I think
that's
it.
Kind of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it's just that there's suggestion of, like, mass death happening outside.
Yeah. So, like, all of Canada is right? gone. All of Pontypool has suffered. Yeah. And then we only get, you noted here, the real money shot is Laurel Ann's death, because we don't, it's, again, it's not a particularly visually gruesome movie. Like, we get described a lot of the terrible things that are happening, but we don't see a lot of it. So, like, it's, again, that's what makes it such an interesting, like, horror, zombie, not zombie movie. We don't see all the shitty things that are happening.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And, part of the film's strength, I think. Especially if you know you're only going to make $32,000 back.
Yeah. Like, don't kill anyone. Fake blood is very expensive.
Yeah. So, Shanice, I think you and I are pretty much in agreement on this, but what would you say didn't work in this movie?
So, I want to preface my note about what didn't work in this movie with the fact that we are working with a story that was a book, then it was a radio play, and then it was a movie, which I think is really, really important to think about, because those are two mediums where words and monologues and, you know, telling your audience what's happening instead of showing them is very, very, very important. And God, the first half of this film does such a great job of showing me, and not showing me in a way that requires, you know, a bunch of bodies or, like, zombies with their arms getting cut off. It shows you because it shows you the panic. It shows you the building of suspense and all of that great stuff. And then the second fucking half of this movie happens, and like, I get it. Listen, I understand the goddamn subtext of this movie. Words are the virus. But it becomes so wordy that I, to, you know, quote their tagline, like, shut the fuck up. Like, just, you know, just stop. Yeah. And I think that part of that is because it had already gone through these two other phases that they had no choice but to include all of these very, very long monologues. But again, I think that the film wouldn't have the message that it does without that. We are meant to feel that way of like, please shut up. Like, everything you're saying is nonsense. None of this sort of matters. And I don't know. It's like, yeah, that's pretty much it. It's, there's a lot. It's very wordy. And I don't love that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree completely. I think the energy of the first half of the film doesn't necessarily carry through to the second half. There's a lot of words, but in the second half of the film, but they're not engaging the way the dialogue of the first half of the film is really like high energy and engaging. And it's like, it's funny and it's fast and, you know, you're getting character details and yeah, the message of the film we kind of get in the second half. And it's like, it's trying to reach for a conceptual sophistication that isn't really there.
Yes.
So yeah, like you said, we get the point fairly quickly. And then sort of the fun of seeing these people put on this like local radio show with all its ups and downs is lost.
Yeah.
And so.
And it's like I said to you before we started recording, it's a sort of thing where like there's a certain point in this film where it reminds me a lot of Inception, of like, I get it. You're really fucking smart. You're super next level. Like, stop stroking yourself and like go back to, you know, doing your story justice.
Right.
But again, like, would I remove that completely? No, because like that's kind of the point.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And we liked this. We both really liked this movie. You know, just little things, little nitpicking things, but I don't know. Maybe if I watched it a second time and I really paid attention to everything that was said in the second half of the movie, more nuances would emerge that they're actually developing the idea rather than just raising it. But
yeah, no. Yeah. In school, the way that we did it was we watched this film, then we read the book, and then we listened to the radio play. And that was super helpful because it really... it like just shows you the breakdown of how to convey the point, the message of this film in these three different mediums. And also just sort of like helped me break down a very complex message that it is sending. So I think like after you listen to the radio play, I think that you'd feel a little differently about like the movie. Not that, like, you don't love it now, but I think that you'd be like, oh, okay, like, fine, you're really smart.
Cool. So, next up is the Run Up the Stairs instead of Out of the House Award for the dumbest decision in this movie.
And we agree here.
Oh, totally, we agree. We tend to say the same thing. Just get out of town, man.
Fucking leave.
The fact that they're staying to, I don't know, keep the radio running, it's noble, I guess. But, yeah. Well, and I guess it's more noble in, like, the middle of the film than the end of the film when they realize that language is the virus. So broadcasting is like might actually be really the most dangerous thing they could do.
Right.
But yeah, just leave town, man.
Yeah.
That, like, seems to do the trick.
It's like, oh, something's wrong outside. Let's just stay and report. And it's like, why? No, why? No one cares. Please just go. Save yourself.
Although, in the movie, we do hear the woman's kids turning. And they are in the city, which I'm assuming is Toronto in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So it is possible that it's spread much wider through Canada than just Pontypool.
That's true. But that's because they're fucking broadcasting.
Right.
Oh, yeah, just leave. Which is also how we would survive this movie. We would have just left.
Right. Right, just leave. At least leave and then get a better sense of how big the problem is and what the problem is. Yeah, it, just like staying in the radio station without any information, at like, it just seems like the worst possible decision.
Truly.
Yeah.
So, like, it's interesting to talk about the historical context of this film, because I don't think that when it came out, it made such a splash in terms of, like, pop culture and the themes that it was approaching. I think that a lot of filmmakers love to talk about or question the meaning of conversation, because as a filmmaker, you yourself are like, why am I doing this? Why are people watching this and enjoying this? I think that this film has become more and more popular as the years have gone by because of that theme in society. We are suddenly a part of a society that like has stuff like social media and Twitter and Facebook, like where people are constantly feeding us their pointless thoughts, their pointless conversations, and we are going through the motions of consuming that. So I think that this film was a little ahead of its time in that way, that I think that everyone, you know, pointless conversation, whatever, we all hate it, ha ha ha. Now it's so much a part of our daily lives that we're like, that's what's making you sick. Like, that's, Twitter is what makes you dumber. Facebook is what, like, is the cancer of your life. So I think it's really interesting that, like, it sort of was on the beginning of the wave of, like, oh, the internet and people thinking that their thoughts are important are going to be the fall of society.
Yeah. Yeah. And the whole idea of language is a virus that infects society and, like, makes people into, I don't know, unthinking creatures, beasts, hosts for these ideas, that sort of thing. Is obviously one that resonates in the 21st century. You know, whether it's like Rush Limbaugh type right-wing talk radio or QAnon or, you know, Fox News, like there's increasingly so many examples of, or, you know, obviously, like you said, Twitter, of the way language infects populations and kind of transforms people's, like, rewires people's brains, right? In some really profound and at times pretty damaging ways. So I think that the parallels there are pretty clear. And we're, like, definitely starting to emerge in 2009, but in 2020 are sort of fully fluorescent and something we're dealing with in a lot of ways.
It's also really interesting to me that, like, it's made very clear in the film that this is spread, the virus is spread by the English language, because a lot of people in Canada are bilingual. You know, in certain parts, they speak French. So I think to make this sort of bold statement of sticking to your mother tongue was a really interesting thing to say then, too. I'm not quite sure what, and probably because I'm not Canadian, but I am bilingual, and it's a sort of thing of, like, you can trust, like, your primary mind in a way. I don't know. It's just, like, a really, really interesting theme to sort of explore.
Yeah, that's interesting. I also love the whole undertone of, like, potential Quebecois separatists, which is sort of a thing. It's definitely, you know, a thing in Infinite Jest, but it is kind of a real life thing too. Although I don't think they're not violent like in this film or in Infinite Jest, the sort of like militant Quebecois separatists.
Right.
But yeah, and you wonder, there's like a hint that this might be something that was seeded by, you know, separatist like groups in Quebec somehow as a way to like decolonize Canada, I guess.
No, for sure.
Yeah. So if we're talking about this movie now, what would this movie be like if it was made in 2020 instead of 2009? I think pretty clearly the internet would change everything here, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think that it wouldn't necessarily be radio, obviously. Not that radio's dead, you're listening to a podcast, but I think that it would be the sort of thing that's spread that quite literally goes viral on Twitter.
Yeah.
And like everyone's retweeting it like a meme. Basically, this movie now, the virus is a goddamn meme. And that's how it's killing everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And also just the idea that a radio station, a local radio station, would be the main source of news and would be sort of having to just aggregate data based on conversations they can have and phone calls they can get and people who come to the station is, I guess, more or less believable in 2009, considering this is like a kind of a rural Ontario town. You know, it's you get the sense internet hasn't really come to this town maybe as much, and it's, you know, people still kind of rely on the local radio and, you know, talking to each other on the phone, like, I don't know, Friday Night Lights or something. Everyone just like goes over to everyone's houses. But today, even if the radio station was still broadcasting, I feel like just the collection of data would have just been a couple of people on their laptops trolling Instagram and Twitter and Facebook instead of, you know, fielding calls and doing the sort of more old school journalism work that they're doing.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Although it is really interesting. I don't know if you've been listening to Rachel Maddow at all about when she talks about the pandemic right now, but she's been getting a lot of the news that she shares from local reporting again, because a lot of the like numbers and stuff, for whatever reason, a lot of states aren't reporting, or they're not reporting up to date numbers or accurate numbers. And so it is interesting to see local reporting be such an asset where, you know, a lot of news groups are like sort of trolling the internet for local like papers that they have a website or something and getting, you know, infection numbers from that. So maybe local reporting is more alive now than we give it credit for. But either way, you know, the internet would be the primary disseminator of information here now.
Yeah, no, it would. So this plot in 10 words, Will, what are your 10 words?
Oh, man, my 10 words are... words are the problem in Canada. That was six.
Straight to the point. I appreciate that. I think for me, it's think before you speak or die.
Yeah, or die, right. Yep, I think that's it.
I guess it's like it's funny to like try to sum up a movie that's about words in 10 words.
Right. And it's so conceptual and so like layered and intellectual. Also, shout out to like the old shock jock. That's another remnant of this film that was, you know, on its last legs in 2009, the sort of Don Imus. Howard Stern is still around doing his thing. I guess you could say Joe Rogan has like stepped up to that role too in a way. But the sort of local radio jock, you know, who's like got some attitude and is going to give you the news his way.
Yeah.
It's not gone, but it's much less of a thing now than it used to be.
Well, it's much less of a character. Like this film works because that was still a caricature that you can reference. And God, again, that casting is so perfect because he's got that voice of like, I'm going to give you the business.
Yeah. So I think this brings us to the end of our infection arc.
It sure does. It's been a very interesting arc because we've covered diseases, which naturally led us to zombies.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like it's a large, like, it's been so hard to fully categorize what this arc was, because so many things fall into this idea of viral and things spreading.
Right. Yeah, it's disease, but it's also just the means of infection and networks and how networks get compromised and infected. And yeah, it's complicated and interesting, obviously. Yeah, there was a lot in this one.
It's definitely, we're gonna have a zombie arc at a later point.
Yeah.
It was definitely the sort of thing where we had to instantly start talking about because quarantine started, IRL. So
yeah,
we had to learn from the movies. Right. Our next arc won't be as grim. We're doing Blumhouse movies.
Yeah, Blumhouse.
So a little more fun for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. We're starting off, I think, with Fantasy Island next
week.
That's
right, yeah.
I'm blanking on her name.
Lucy Hale.
That's right. That's funny, because I, like we said, she's the...
You've met her.
I met her a few weeks ago. She was perfectly nice. but, yeah, the Lucy Hale... Blumhouse horror about all your wishes coming true, and that might not actually be a good thing.
Yeah, what does that mean? Do you really want all your wishes to come true? Who knows? We're doing Fantasy Island, then Invisible Man, which is another released very early at home film because of quarantine. Mm-hmm. That is like a remake, but not a remake. Right. And then Oculus and Ouija.
Ouija. I cannot wait to watch Ouija. I have not seen it.
Oh God, it's great. I have no so expectations. Stupid.
Awesome.
But yeah, we're going to have a lot of fun finally with our next arc. Not that this wasn't fun, but you know, I'm just tired of seeing other people get sick, man.
I know it. Yeah. Next week's going to kick off Blumhouse. Yeah, this one is going to be a lot of fun. Fun movies, like just, I think a lot of just old school, fun, goofy horror, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can find us on social at JumpScarePod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can email us thoughts for next arcs or next movies at JumpScarePod@gmail.com. Yeah, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Bye.
You're listening to Mischief Media, the podcast network that takes stories and fandom seriously. Mischief Media has a whole collection of amazing podcasts like Make New Mistakes about being women in business, or Pottercast, the long-running podcast about Harry Potter, or Roll 9 3/4 by the same folks about doing a D&D campaign set at Hogwarts. All these and more, including our podcast Jump Scare about horror films. There is so much to enjoy on Mischief Media. Go to mischiefmedia.com and we'll see you there.
Y'all, we have some really exciting news to share with you. You can officially support Mischief Media and Jump Scare with our very own Patreon. That means that you can join us and support us in doing something really cool. One of the best things about our Patreon is that we've got a private Discord where you can meet fans just like you that have got big feelings about fandom. You've also got access to all of the Mischief Media hosts, including Will and I, where we get to talk about our favorite new trailers and movies that are coming out, which is something that we don't really get to do on our podcast. What does it mean to be a patron, Will?
Being a patron really helps us out. It means you're directly helping us bring you better quality sound, better edits, brand new shows, more episodes of your favorite shows. I mean, so many things that we just are dying to do and create. I mean, working here, I can tell you, new ideas come up every single day. And besides the fact that we all need time turners to get them all done, you know, we need financial support for some of these ideas. And being a patron really allows us to, you know, go hard on those ideas and really bring you the best possible content across all of our platforms.
So you get physical merch, you've got that private Discord community, and you've also got bonus recorded content from us, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You've got Will and I talking about our favorite horror movies, our favorite tropes, our favorite things that necessarily don't really fit into our episodes. You also, at some point, will get to listen to an episode of Will and I super fucking drunk breaking our podcast studio. And it's a lot of fun, so please just join us. It's patreon.com/makingmischief.
Absolutely. Can't wait to see you there.